it always seems funny to me to be sort of up here looking out, especially in such distinguished company of speakers as we have had the last couple of days. I mean, very rarely have I been at conferences that have such consistently extraordinary talks, and that makes me feel even more sort of on the line and on the gun and humbled by being asked by the committee to share some thoughts. I want to do really two things as our closing session. The first part of the presentation, I want to share with you some thoughts about what we might do from here, where we go, and some thoughts about the relationship between our community in North America and the communities in the rest of the world. And then, after sharing some of those thoughts, have an opportunity for each of us to reflect on some things that we might be able to do. One of the, I think, greatest joys and also one of the greatest terrors of being a Baha'i is that tomorrow morning when we wake up, there will be nobody to tell us what to do. Now that's a very great privilege because it means that we have a tremendous range of activity. But it also can be very frightening if we are looking for some specific directions or specific guidance. I have often thought that it would be very reassuring. I don't know if you've ever gone to sleep at night. I don't know if you have dreams. Is that maybe tonight will be the night when I have the dream where everything will become clear? Yeah, that, and I'll know what to do tomorrow morning when I wake up, that I'll go and I'll send in my resume here and I'll get it, and all of that will be absolutely clear, and I know that that's what I have to do. My own personal experience is the guidance has very rarely been that direct. Instead, it's been sort of a process of, okay, now I've got this set of general principles that I have to somehow figure out how they will apply to my life. When I'm talking with organizations, a lot of my current professional work is with large corporations, which are very, very large organizations of 20, 30, 40,000 people within one company who have broad organizational goals. And it's interesting that they talk to me about exactly the same problem. They have a general sense of what they need to do. There are some general goals and general principles, but then they have to reflect and say, now what is it that I am supposed to do? Now, I often make the distinction between principle-guided behavior and rule-guided behavior or regulation-guided behavior. Now, if you have a set of regulations, then historically and traditionally, bureaucracies and large organizations have been governed by regulations. You have a set of procedures that says when you get this letter, you should do this, 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 and this. When somebody asks this question, you do this, 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 and this. You develop a whole elaborate set of policies for dealing with new situations so that everything is very tightly controlled. Well, the Baha'i approach to organization is really very different from that. The Baha'i approach is that there, in many cases, are not to be policies. There are specifically not to be precedents. Every administrative case is to be judged totally afresh, as though it's never been dealt with before, in a sense. And no decision is made for this person because 10 years ago we happened to make the decision and it was sort of similar, so let's do the same thing. None of that is the process of Baha'i administration and consultation. Instead, the House of Justice has clarified that we guide our lives and our administrative structures by reflection on a set of spiritual principles that were given to us by the central figures of the faith and that continue to be interpreted and clarified for us and eventually augmented by our administrative institutions. So when we wake up in the morning, we get that very comforting thought that he whose words exceed his deeds, verily his death is better than his life. And we think, okay, I've got a tremendous opportunity. Isn't that comforting? We've got a great chance to charge out and exemplify ourselves in action. Well, there's another wrinkle to this whole thing, and that's the fact that in many, many cases, the actions that Baha'is engage in as part of our administrative structures, as part of the implementing of the world order, are almost identical to the actions that everybody else is engaged in. And if you make a list of the things that Baha'is do and the things that other organizations do, and you look at them sort of superficially, you say, well, all these people are doing the same thing. The point that was raised yesterday, which is very, very critical, and I want to share some things from Abdul Baha's discussion of what civilization is to sort of support this notion. But what emerged yesterday is the thing that is fundamentally different about every Baha'i approach and every Baha'i organization is that the motivations for our activities are fundamentally different from the motivations of traditional structures and traditional organizations. I'm going to expand on that in several different ways. And not to go too heavily into sort of methodological discussions and theory too much, but I do want to touch just a little bit on the different ways that we have to talk about and think about the way we do things. And I won't go too heavy into philosophy, but I want to share one story about John Locke, who is an English philosopher who's often considered the sort of father of Western thinking about how we know what we know and the nature of reality and things like that. He started off his discussion of the nature of existence by quoting an Indian philosophy and quoting the traditional Hindu version, he says, of how the world came into being and what the world is. And he quotes the, quote, Indian mystic as saying, the world is an egg, and the egg rides on the back of a leopard. The leopard rides on the back of an elephant. The elephant rides on the back of a great serpent. The serpent rides on the back of a tremendous turtle. And the turtle rides on the back of something, I know not what. And he used this notion, in fact, of the levels of existence, that the superficial reality that we call the egg of the world rides on the back of something, on the back of something, and getting ever deeper and deeper, until finally this something I know not what, and then spent thousands and thousands of words trying to define the something I know not what. I mean, it's a remarkable treatise when you look at it from that point of view. The Egyptians had the same kind of analogy when they said that the world is like an onion, that we have the outside of the world. When you peel off the outside layer, you have another layer. And you peel off that layer, and there's another layer, and that layer. And that you can peel down layer upon layer upon layer, and all of a sudden the onion is gone, but all that's really happened is that you reach the bottom layer. As a very good analogy I found in my own personal experience for the process of what we call deepening in the writings. We have our initial reaction, the superficial layer, and then we go down and down and down and down. Well, in the same way, there's several ways that we can talk about development activities, or a term that I often prefer to use is sort of community service activities in the broad sense. And I want to just describe what, just real briefly, four levels that I'm going to be referring to. At the broadest, I'll write and then talk, which is easier. Sort of top level, and this is the level that is talked about at great length in the writings of the central figures of the faith, are the general purposes of civilization, the purposes of mankind, the purposes of social organization. Okay. There's a layer of discourse. One way to think about these is to talk about different levels of discourse, or different ways of talking about the things that we do in the world. Okay. Broad level of purposes, there's another layer of goals that are getting more specific in terms of these are things that we ought to be doing, and yet which are not quite specifying exactly what we do. Then another layer is we can start to talk about structures. You know, an obvious structure, for example, is the local spiritual assembly. That is getting even more specific and yet still doesn't quite tell us what we're going to do the next day. And then the most specific is is the level of what I call activities or actions. These are things that we're going to do. We're going to hold a conference, or we're going to distribute a set of materials, or we're going to develop a slideshow. The specific things that we will do around the specific purposes. Yeah? Now, the structure of the comments that I'm going to share with you, I'm going to look at these different levels. For any of those of you who are interested in the theoretical part, you'll know right away that theoreticians divide each of these levels into subcategories, and they talk about what's goals and what's objectives and what's purposes and stuff. I'm not going to do any of that at all, but you might want to know that people do have a lot of arguments about how they use those terms. Okay, for what we're going to do today, I think this is sufficient. Now, the question is, okay, here we all are. We're at Greenacre. We are currently in North America. Many of us expect to live in North America for the next little while. And yet it's very clear from the messages of the House of Justice most recently, and as it was pointed out historically throughout the history of the North American community, that we have a role in the world as well that is much larger than our particular role in our own local communities. How do we get a grip on that? Now, we've been talking about development, and we have a general sense that the sense of development is the development of civilization. And the first question that we have to really ask is, all right, what is the purpose of development? And the next question down below that, if development is an ever-advancing civilization, what is the purpose of civilization? What is this concept of civilization? What constitutes good civilization as opposed to bad civilization, or is any civilization equally good? Several people have referred to the Secret of Divine Civilization as a sort of handbook of development. And I was interested to hear that because more and more recently I've been realizing that there are some very penetrating and powerful analyses of the development of civilizations in Abdu'l-Bahá's work. And I wanted to share a couple of quotes about his view of development and true civilization. Now, he was writing this book. This was a very early work by Abdu'l-Bahá, the 1870s. Yeah. Okay, now, think, I've often thought how wonderful to be alive in the 1870s. You know, I have a lot of arts background, and if you think of the 1870s in European culture, there were really some very wonderful things going on. I think Brahms' Fourth Symphony, which is one of my most favorite artistic creations, was created right about the time, somewhere in the 1860s, 1870s, and a tremendous flowering of European culture. So it's very interesting to know that Abdu'l-Bahá, who was alive at the time of this efflorescence of what many people regard as the classical fruits of European civilization, had to say about his assessment of this civilization. And here is his comment. It's the whole section you might want to reread. I'll just share a few things starting on page 60. All the peoples of Europe, notwithstanding their vaunted civilization, sink and drown in this terrifying sea of passion and desire. And here's his assessment. And this is why all the phenomena of their culture come to nothing. And then he goes on, he says, let no one wonder at this statement or deplore it. And goes on to explain that this, and he goes on a little further, results which would win the good pleasure of God and secure the peace and well-being of man could never be fully achieved in a merely external civilization. So that, again, if we look at the outmost layer of the onion, that can be very attractive. The core may be rotten. And unless you slice the onion in half and you know what's inside, it's very difficult to know from an external judgment whether or not this is in fact true, whether or not this is in fact good reality. He goes on to say very specifically, then, the peoples of Europe have not advanced to the higher planes of moral civilization. Now, it's interesting to note that almost all of the models for cultural institutions, for our social structures, for virtually all of the organizational structures we use in our civilization and that we as Baha'is are involved in implementing in other parts of the world are very squarely based on European civilization, very squarely based on European structures, which Abdu'l-Bahá says come to nothing. Very interesting. And then over on the next page, he says, be just. can this nominal civilization, unsupported by a genuine civilization of character, bring about the peace and well-being of the people, or win the good pleasure of God? Does it not rather connote the destruction of man's estate and pull down the pillars of happiness and peace? And then he goes on for a very detailed discussion of what was happening in the time of the development of arms, and he talks about, you know, they're priding themselves on developing a new kind of weapon, and secretly they are saying that they want peace, and secretly they're building up their armaments. And then he talks at great length about how France conquers Prussia, and Prussia conquers France, and France conquers Prussia, and hundreds of thousands of lives are lost. And he says, can this be anything to do with civilization? And yet when you look at that, we find out that in fact that culture has been effectively transmitted to the entire world. El Salvador conquers Nicaragua, Nicaragua conquers El Salvador, da-da-da-da-da, Israel conquers Jordan, Jordan conquers Israel. Everyone has picked up very, very effectively the Western model of civilization, which is to have a show of peace and friendliness at the same time that you are making plans for the destruction and seizing of material property. And this model is essentially the same whether it's, as it's been pointed out numerous times, capitalism, communism, whatever kind of model. The underlying motivation of all of these things is material gain and material pursuit. And that's why all of those phenomena come to nothing. It's also interesting when we look at the question of development. You know, we've talked a lot about statistics of various factors of civilization and how we measure who's developed and who's not developed. And there's a whole set of criteria. Some of you may be familiar with the concept of LDCs, least developed countries. There's a whole set of criteria that, in fact, there are some of the 25 LDCs according to certain criteria of things like infant mortality and nutritional status and education rates and illiteracy and things like that. That is a set of statistics geared largely towards being able to estimate this country's ability to participate in a Western-style economic order. I mean, that's really what those things are indicators of, primarily. Okay? There's another very interesting set of statistics that you don't find in those books, and where you get a very different stacking of development in countries. I have not done this, but I can imagine the results of making a chart of the countries who have looking at the comparative rates of child and teenage suicide. Many of you may be familiar that the United States has the honor of having the highest teenage suicide rate and child suicide rate of any country in the world. Is that the mark of a developed civilization? And how do we measure that? Or look again, it broke my heart. I have a 5-year-old daughter who goes to a very progressive nursery school, kindergarten. I mean, sort of all of the fruits of a civilization. Really, it's a very good school. Towards the end of the school year, they had to have a session bringing all of the parents together to view a film that they were going to show the children, and that they did show the children, teaching the children how to defend themselves against kidnapping, child molestation, sexual abuse, and assault. My 5-year-old daughter is already having to deal with how you talk to strangers in a way that will keep you from getting hurt. Is this the mark of a true civilization? Is this what is exported around the world? And is this part of what we're involved in as American Baha'i community? Well, I think the answer is obvious from the look on everybody's face as we think about this, is that no, this has nothing to do with true civilization. And this is finally the bubbling to the surface of the things that Abdu'l-Bahá pointed out over 100 years ago as being a civilization, all the phenomena of which come to nothing. So we need to say to ourselves, as a Baha'i community, what are our motivations? If we have rejected the materialistic conception, then how do we use a new kind of motivation? What motivations do we draw on, and what kinds of structures do those motivations generate? And it seems to me that that's the level of discussion that the House of Justice message is really starting to stimulate in all of our communities. And, you know, as Rob pointed out, there have been letters almost the entire history of this Baha'i community saying these things, but it is becoming very clear. I'd like to also mention a little bit of the process. Any of you who were out in Chicago and heard the just exhilarating talk by Irvin Laszlo, who, as you know, is not a Baha'i, but is director of the United Nations Institute for Training and Research, UNITAR, and who for many years has been a philosopher and a scholar and has worked in systems theory and really advanced intellectual analysis of the future of the world and the nature of the world. He is working with a group, this is partly through the Club of Rome, drawing on the work of theoretical physics, theoretical chemistry, theoretical sociology, all of these theoreticians who are looking, who in fact see that the world very possibly is on the edge of a tremendous transformation, and who have begun to explain the process of transformation as being really very different from previous understandings. And in fact, he explained the process of transformation as it's now understood by science in almost exactly the same terms that Baha'u'llah explains it in his writings over 100 years ago. But I'll give an example. The summary of it is that they have now come to the conclusion that transformation, rather than being slow and gradual and imperceptible, proceeds by being imperceptible for a very long period of time, and then suddenly, once a certain foundation is laid, a change occurs. It can be called paradigm shifts or transformational structures. And he gives the example of ice and the way that ice forms in a pool of water. The first thing that happens in the ice is that there are little points throughout the water that crystallize. It's like they form little ice nuggets or little ice seeds. They're not related to each other at all, but literally throughout the water you have these little points. Then the next thing that happens is slowly these points start to join up, and they have a technical terms, but essentially it's like a lattice work where these points start to develop connections as though there's a network throughout all of these points, and these points develop and develop, and the network gets thicker and thicker. And then within just a fraction of a period of time, as it's measured chemically, it reaches a critical point and it becomes ice. And it's really very exciting. You know, just the next time you have an ice cube. It's a great day to talk about ice, too. Okay. Well, in essence, their theory is that this is what should happen with social change, that there should be lots of points that manifests the new principles of organization. And if the new paradigm is unity, there should be numerous points throughout the world of unity. And what was it that Glenn Afford called it, referred to Abdu'l-Bahá's statement of collective centers of unity? Numerous points here that become connected with each other and also connected with the world around them, and then through that means affect a global transformation in the way that society is organized. One of the most exciting things to me about the whole process of the last few years is that it seems clear that as a Baha'i community, we are moving in to a new kind of interconnectedness among ourselves on a global level. And just the discussions shared a few minutes ago about what the people are doing in Papua New Guinea and what they're doing in Samoa and what they're doing in Nigeria and all of these corners of the world, and sharing those interconnections suggests to me that this process of creating the network and reaching out into the community at large is in fact a substantive stage, maybe not a new stage exactly, because the process has been clear all along, but it's reaching a stage of perceptibility in the set of world events that is starting to have significant effect on the community at large, and in fact is generating the kind of recognition that we have been told for many, many years would be coming to the Baha'i community, and that increasingly the world at large will be looking to the Baha'i community for leadership. We also know, as members of the American Baha'i community, that we have had the finger pointed to us by, well, really initially the Bab calling on the West to arise. and Baha'u'llah, and very specifically Abdu'l-Bahá, saying specifically that North America, not just the United States, but that North America would have a preponderating role in creating peace around the world. And if we look at this process of how this has occurred, there is a very intimate connection between what is going on in the Baha'i communities in North America and what is happening in the Baha'i communities in the rest of the world. You know, the Americans continually are going out and going into the rest of the world. And there was the question asked yesterday, well, is this the time now where everybody leaves and goes out? Exactly the same kind of question during the World Crusade. You know, during the World Crusade, Shoghi Effendi sent letters almost monthly saying, more people leave and go and settle the cities. And he set up an honor roll of people that were Knights of Baha'u'llah for the first ones to make it to an unopened locality, and very suddenly expanded the number of localities all around the world. And there's this cryptic little cablegram in one of his sets of messages in Citadel to the Faith, where, and it has to be footnoted because it's so cryptic, he says, information incorrect. All assemblies must be maintained. And they put a footnote saying that the National Assembly had cabled the House of Justice that someone had said, that Shoghi Effendi said, that everybody was supposed to leave the United States and go around the world. And in fact, it was just the opposite. The goals for the United States were the most substantial goals in the history of the faith to that time. So that there's a double process of stimulated activity in the rest of the world and increased vitality of activity on the home front. More assemblies around the world, more assemblies at home. More connections with the leaders of thought around the world, more connections with the leaders of thought here at home in the United States. And I've thought quite a bit about what is this dynamic interaction. I mean, there's clearly a very critical connection. And if you think about it, I mean, just a very small example, okay? But it was something that Leela, my wife, and I were talking about last night. Look at the Baha'i development projects in India, okay? Some of the people involved in those projects, Steve Waite, Ray Johnson, Vasudevan Nair, Fly River, Tafaki, all of those people had critical roles. All of those individuals happen to have been educated at the University of Massachusetts, right here in the United States. So that there is a very direct effect of activities here affecting the rest of the world. And it seems to me that this dynamic is going to become even more substantial. This, in some ways, is really almost a training ground and an educational ground. And there's another reason, too, I think, that this is true. You know, Baha'u'llah said that the reason the revelation came to Persia, to Iran, was not because it was the holiest place on earth, but because, in fact, it was the darkest. The Americans, as the spiritual descendants, we could say, well, it's because the Americans are the best and the greatest. I think it's probably a more likely assumption that Americans are living in the place where the efflorescence of materialistic culture has reached its greatest excesses, and where, in fact, in the darkest heart of the darkest heart, American civilization is the focal point of all of that. And people, I'm convinced, will look back in the future and wonder how any of us survived in a civilization like ours. Yeah, it's sort of astonishing to think, but I am firmly convinced. I am not of the school of catastrophe theory within the Baha'i community that there's going to be one big blow and boom, that's the catastrophe. I think we have been living in the catastrophe, and that in fact it exists all around us,